You still looking for rural properties?
Trying to, but I can't believe how fast the prices went up this year, you know?
Yeah, no kidding, eh? I mean, it's part of our whole discussion on the voodoo economics that has gripped the world. Although, and obviously I should say this, but whatever. I think the timing is all the election. That, you know, regardless of the result of the election, after election day, I think that's when everything's going to unravel.
Yeah. I was about to say entirely possible, but now I want to change that to entirely likely. And it is not a function of the outcome. It's a function of the occurrence, you know?
Yes. And the lead up to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the tension.
Right? Like there's all this, you know, it's all this anxiety. Anyway, I don't want to get into it now because it's fodder for the show, but.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
There he is.
Hey, thanks. Sorry I'm a bit late. Had to reboot, etc.
Yeah. Charles Hugh Smith, the man of the hour.
So have you guys started recording?
We started recording. I already tested. So we have good. Charles Hugh Smith arriving late from the Big Island in Hawaii. Jesse Hirsch from the Ottawa Valley. I'm Mark Jeftovic. Welcome to the Access of Easy Salon number 17. We're taping this on August the 13th, my lucky number. And what do you guys want to talk about today?
Well, I want to talk about your Uber Lyft death of the unicorn externalized cost model, which means the death of Silicon Valley, which we can all cheer, yes, which relates to something I want to touch on at least, which is something that Jesse has brought up numerous times, which is the death of the nation state. And so Disney, Walmart, Apple et al. Are semi-outraged that a nation state could interrupt their business. I mean, talk about just beyond. I mean, what right does a nation state have to mess with my profit stream?
Let me just interrupt before I let Jesse in. That would be excusable outrage if they weren't having their bonds bought by the Fed with money printed out of thin air and did not rely on a monetary system that the nation state created to lift their boats, right? Go ahead.
Well said. I really want to see a visualization because, again, I'm a monetary neophyte, an economic village idiot. And I have been sort of cluing and reading into the way in which the printing money machine has been used to then buy bonds to prop up the stock market. And I think it would make a fantastic visualization that if you could see this graphic of the money being created and then how it flows and in what quantities and to which companies and sort of what that means and what that entails, especially in the bubble sense of boosting up these prices. I just think that would be a very effective means of illustrating exactly what's happening, exactly what the consequences were, and would make it a lot easier for my fellow village idiots to wrap their heads around exactly what's going on.
No, that's a great idea because you could take like the lump sums, you know, the billions would be these huge bubbles, and then there'd be these little tiny pennies that flow to, you know, the bottom 99% or bottom 95%. And that would be much more impactful than, yeah, just talking about it.
I've been working on, so I bought that software program called Doodly or something like that. So you can make doodle videos very, very easily. And my first project to just sort of learn that software is, you know, quantitative easing explained. And I've been meaning to finish that off. And every once in a while, I'll add a few slides to it and stuff. But you're absolutely right, because I think it has the potential to be one of those, you know, story of stuff kind of viral videos that just finally when people
explains it,
when people understand what it means, because otherwise it tends to be an eyes glaze over kind of conversation until you finally kind of grasp the enormity of the scam being perpetuated.
Yeah. But to Mark, to your point, yeah, I think that's a good launching point. Like you said, corporate America, global corporations all depend on the nation state to manage their money supply and keep them top dogs, you know, at the top of the heap. And yet they obviously actively resent any imposition of the self-interest of the nation state if it impacts, you know, their greed and profitability.
But I think if anything, that's the definition of the network state, that the nation state, weakened by the wave of new technologies, has been reconfigured into a peer-to-peer function in which the transnational corporations are not subjects of the state, they're peers of the state. And they're on the same horizontal plane in terms of how the network is configured. And that's part of why you can't command them to do stuff. You got to ask them to do stuff. You need to incentivize them to do stuff. Because in that regard, the state, at least aspects of the state, have been relatively weak for some time. Because, you know, to prime your Uber discussion, Uber's whole business model was to ask for forgiveness rather than ask for permission. Right? And that's the classic definition of the network state, where you're not afraid of law enforcement. You're just arrogant that because you're so far ahead of law enforcement that you're leading them. Because of course Uber then turns around and uses their data to cooperate with law enforcement when it comes to dealing with crimes. So it's a much more complicated process that I think demonstrates that the old notion of the state being supreme, or the state having the monopoly just on violence but all sorts of different authority in society, that's gone. And that the network state has replaced it as much more of a constellation of powers that includes the state or includes the government, but also includes all these other arms of the empire. I sort of alluded to this today in my post about digital imperialism, that, you know, we also have to remember the way in which the internet changes our relationship with space and time. And so the American digital empire, vis-a-vis Facebook, exists outside of the territorial United States. And as a form of digital imperialism, Facebook has been fantastic at conquest, at cognitive conquest, at conquering people's minds. So, you know, TikTok was just another player in digital imperialism, but on the other side. And they were the first to successfully invade the territorial United States, quite effectively so. And so now that's why the American empire is starting to say, maybe we should champion the other partners in our network. And then to your point, it's interesting that other elements of the network are going, maybe not. Maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Maybe we should sacrifice Facebook's bottom line to make sure that Apple's bottom line is protected, or that Disney's bottom line is protected. Because that's where you get into the idea that maybe Facebook is the one with the real power here, and they're the one most threatened by TikTok. I'm rambling, but you get the idea.
Well, have we all read Snow Crash? Everyone on this, Charles, have you read Snow Crash?
Okay. No. Well,
Snow Crash had a big effect on me.
I wish I could say watch the movie, but
you know what? I'm kind of happy you can't say watch the movie, because the movie would probably suck. Anyway. There's this scene in Snow Crash, and it's been such a long time since I read it that I can't remember it exactly. But you know how when there's some sort of joint law enforcement operation and various members of various law enforcement agencies are running around with these sort of rain jackets on that have the initials of the agency they work for emblazoned on the back, like DEA and FBI, and this conveys some sort of, you know, level of authority to them. If you're walking around with one of these jackets, you're one of the power players in this equation. And there's this sort of crescendo climactic scene at the end of Snow Crash where all of these different conflicting power factions are descending on this one scene, and these two guys are up in this sort of bird's eye view looking down, and the one guy looks at the other and he kind of taps him on the shoulder, reaches behind, and the guy had his flap up. He forgot to, you know, you have to have your flap down so people know who you are, and his was Mafia, right? So these two guys were in the Mafia, but they were like as ensconced and powerful in society that they were kind of jockeying for position in this battle along with FBI and DEA and stuff like that. But all of this, where you were talking about, Jesse, brings us back to, you know, we've been wanting to do the geopolitics of TikTok for a few episodes now. And where I always wanted to get to with that conversation was that it seemed to me like this Cold War, this next sort of generational confrontation globally, is being fought with weapons that we don't even recognize are weapons anymore. And it's kind of good news and it's kind of bad news. I mean, the good news is it's better than a hot conflict with shooting and stuff, but it's like there's this economic conflict, there's this cyber conflict, there's this cognitive conflict that I think a lot of people may not even understand that we're in this kind of conflict. And then even the boundaries upon which it's happening are not completely understood, because like you said, Jesse, it's not just between countries and nation states and geopolitical blocks, it's also between, you know, one corporate behemoth and another corporate behemoth within the same geopolitical block, and they could be squaring off and aligning with orthogonal geopolitical blocks, and it really becomes complex and poorly understood very quickly.
Jesse, go ahead.
No, I would just say agreed.
Well, let's delve into that. And one of the first things I think about is how China, as the so-called new arising empire, right, which you could say, or just simply the old empire that's wanting to reclaim its place of glory at the top of the heap, how do they handle things like Uber and Lyft? Corporate new models from outside China. Well, they just snuff them. It's real simple. You know, it just becomes impossible to do business in China. Then you sell the shards of your business to the Chinese competitor that basically copied your model, right? And that's exactly how ride sharing worked. And then, one of the equations here is what fits your ideological narrative. And so the US is in a sense hobbled by this ideological narrative that we're a free market economy, right? So that somebody could come in like TikTok, and if they have a better mousetrap, then well, you know, they have won the rights to their dominance, right? But then it runs up against these other forces that we're starting to talk about. The Chinese government doesn't really have any of those scruples because it doesn't have that narrative to defend, right? So there's that thing. And then, of course, if you can't defend your narrative, then you're hypocritical, right? So it's sort of like a Machiavellian process, too. If you want to devolve your narrative to where it's actually defensible by observation of the real world, right? And so that's partly why I think, Mark, you're right in saying the boundaries are shifting or hard to discern, because in addition to scrambling to secure some sort of power or counterweight, then everybody's trying to come up with a narrative that doesn't expose them to immediate accusations of hypocrisy, right? Which count, right? I mean, there's something
yes
there.
Yes, no. I really agree. I appreciate what you're saying, and I appreciate the way in which this narrative and agree with its role. But I think where I differ is on the relevance of hypocrisy, especially in Chinese politics. Because I think hypocrisy is something that Western politics focuses on a little more. And I think there are elements of Chinese politics that thrive off exposing hypocrisy. But I think what the Chinese political system has that Western systems no longer have and greatly lament is an authoritative narrative. Because the idea of an authoritative narrative, whether it's coming from the state-based media or the state itself, the West no longer has that. I mean, any narrative that comes from a government in the West is mocked, if not derided, and assumed to be hypocritical, if not much worse. Versus the nature of the Chinese authoritative narrative is, you know, it doesn't have to be accurate. It doesn't have to be true. It doesn't have to be hypocritical or not hypocritical. It just has to be something that everyone else can reference. And that, you know, everybody kind of knows that the government hides things. Everybody knows that the government makes mistakes and covers them up. Everybody knows that the government does what the West would call being hypocritical. But I don't think they say it, they think of it in the same way. And as long as the authoritative narrative is the same for everybody, as long as they can refer to it, and as long as the police state is effective in quelling any opponents to that authoritative narrative, I think that that from a political science perspective offers the Chinese government a very powerful handrail by which to govern. And I think bringing it back to social media, what's dangerous about social media is that it makes an authoritative narrative impossible. And where TikTok is incredibly powerful here in North America is it gives a different reality than all other realities, different than Facebook, different than the mainstream media, different than the government, different than everything. So from a subversion perspective, from a surveillance perspective, from a competitive perspective, to Mark's point, it's a very powerful weapon in this game between empires, in this contest for hegemony. And to your point, Charles, the Chinese have controlled their market, have controlled their economy in such a way that Facebook has no footing in China. Most American companies do not have much of a footing in China. And that too creates an ability to have that authoritative narrative. And the control that the Chinese government wields on their internet and on their media allows them to have that authoritative narrative. And so to bring it back to where I think you were starting from, Charles, in terms of the subversive power of hypocrisy, I think the real threat to the Chinese Communist Party would be if there was the equivalent of TikTok in China. If there was a social media platform, or aptly put, a narrative platform that was injected into the country like opium and allowed to flourish and become popular without it being controlled by the central government, that would be the type of threat, of existential threat to the Chinese government as we know it. And the fact that Western powers have not been successful in doing that, I think speaks volumes. Because I can't be the only person to sort of say, hey, this is the tool that we need to undermine and destroy the authoritative narrative of the Chinese government. And so I think that's why, if I was the American government, I wouldn't be saying, hey, how do we ban TikTok? I'd be saying, how do we pull a TikTok on China? Because that's exactly the type of tactic that we need to do in terms of how this digital war is escalating.
That's a lot easier.
And maybe that's blockchain, right? Like, maybe that's, to go back to, you know, our previous currents, maybe that's where the whole blockchain stuff, because boy, does China love that stuff. Mm-hmm. Boy, have they swallowed that Trojan horse. So maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the West isn't incompetent. I'm just not, my eyes are not on their prize.
Well, I was going to say it's a lot easier said than done, because they do exercise such control top down, directly, unabashedly in China. You reminded me, I haven't even thought of this since it happened, but around, has to be 10 years ago, we were approached by a router company, and I won't even say the name because I can't remember for sure which one it was, to do a dynamic DNS offering in China. And there, it would have been a huge deal for us. And then they were saying, okay, but we have to talk about how we're going to implement the border controls around what the Chinese clients can and cannot see outside the Great Wall of, you know, the internet firewall. And we were telling them, well, we're not really equipped to do that. We're a small company. We don't even have the personnel to even tackle it. And they're like, well, no problem. We'll just give you enough money to hire a whole team to do all this. And at that point I realized we were about to be, like, you know, b- bought out by China. And I just thought, no, we'll just, this isn't the business we wanted to be in. So we just didn't go ahead and do that. But
to be a cog in the great Chinese firewall.
I know, I know. I don't, I think I would have.
Oh, to aspire.
Yeah. And I saw an article just yesterday how, you know, TikTok was basically, they were called out for suppressing anti-China content in Indonesia right up until just a couple of months ago. So, I mean, I would almost say there's less hypocrisy out of the Chinese approach because they just don't even try to hide it. It's just like, yeah, this is just the way it is. So
there's no such thing as hypocrisy if there's no shame.
That's an excellent point. Yeah.
So here's the the chink in the armor of an authoritarian narrative, like China's or any place else, is ultimately there's an implicit social contract in China that you let us rule, you follow our rules, and everyone will become more prosperous. Now, it doesn't have to be, it's a relative, as just as it is here, right? In other words, if someone that's making $1,000 a year in China can look forward to making $2,000, he or she doesn't really care if somebody with $10 billion is going to make $30 billion. Right. It's like, as long as I'm getting ahead in my social circle and my life, then things are good, right? And so the I think part of where China's done is the more successful empire at this particular juncture is they made that implicit promise, which is the same, which is shared with every empire and every nation state. Every nation state, whether it's, you know, developing, developed, imperial, whatever. That's the implicit social contract everywhere. Well, in the West, that's failed, right? In other words, people, I mean, by every measure, like the number of hours it takes to buy healthcare, higher education, childcare, at least in the US, it's like you've lost ground since the early 70s. You know, that the bottom 90% have lost ground. It takes more hours of labor to buy these services. Sure, TVs are cheaper, clothes are cheaper, but those are like less than a percent of your total, you know, consumption.
And they're also all made in China.
Right, yeah. And if they weren't made there, they'd be made in, you know, somewhere else that's even cheaper. but China has successfully pulled that off since they opened up in 78. It's been more or less onward and upward with a little speed bump in the Asian contagion around 1998. And then there's been slowing recently, right? There's decay in that momentum. And a lot of people that are smarter than I am and follow energy more closely, I think they've done a pretty persuasive job of saying it's all about the energy density, the energy cost, and the availability. And so the world has been pumping like around 87 million barrels a day for quite some time, between 85 and 90. Well, it's maxed out. And so lots of government agencies say, oh, it's going to go to 120 million a day and this and that. And a lot of other sort of delusional green guys, green energy, are saying, oh, no, we're going to, you know, electrify the entire economy, et cetera, et cetera. Forgetting little tiny details like every electric car has 750 pounds of oil-based plastic in it. I guess what I'm bringing up is that on top of the digital platform wars we're talking about, or conflicts, or areas of contention, right, which are powerful, right, then there's the old good old stuff like food and fresh water and energy, right? All that stuff's got to be affordable to the masses, and they have to actually be increasing their purchasing power of all that basic stuff, or they're going to feel like their prosperity is slipping away, which is the experience in the West, right? Certainly in Europe and Japan and the US, right? The overdeveloped world. So we have to throw that kind of material world stuff into the mix here too.
I think that's a great point because, and you're probably, I'm going to hazard to guess, you're referring to people like Chris Martinson and Jim Kunstler and Dmitry Orlov when they say it all comes down to energy input per person, per whatever, right? If that energy input is going up, you're almost the entire level of prosperity of the society is going up. if the energy input is going up. And if the utopian dream is we can all increase our energy throughput without wrecking the environment through our waste output, through renewables or however else we're going to do that.
Right.
In China, right, material prosperity is still increasing. And that, at the end of the day, is what matters the most. Now, people can make the argument that China has gone and built themselves an even larger credit bubble than we have here in the West. And so when that does pop, it's going to be even uglier than ours. But at the moment, it is not popping, and it's not, you know, it's not showing the same kind of structural damage as ours has. Here in the West, you can tell people you have freedom of speech, you can tell people you have freedom of association, you have more opportunity, blah, 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 blah. But if their material prosperity is not going up, and their kids are worse off than they are, and their children's children are going to be worse off than they are, it's not going to matter in the end. That's all that really matters. Parenthetically, I was listening to a podcast with Max Kaiser again a while ago. Now, he's a solar energy believer, and he thinks that as the efficiencies will come down and we will move more toward that in the future, and he could be right. But he said something interesting. He said, you know, the world maxed out at 90 million barrels a day in oil, and we will never hit 90 million barrels a day again, ever. And I thought, you know, that could have been peak oil in a way that we didn't understand peak oil when the concept first came out. When Hubbert just, you know, laid out the case for Hubbert's peak, it was that this is the peak discovery, and from here on in, it's all going to go down. But now we know, because of fracking, which is a whole other conversation, we have what looks like an oil glut. But owing to the nature of the economy and the imbalances and stuff, oil consumption is actually down at the moment, and it may never surpass that 90 million barrels a day. We may have hit peak oil, and that could be it. And that could be how we sort of measure what happens on that energy input side of things. Sorry, go ahead, Jesse.
Well, I was just going to say, we talk a lot here about the rearview mirror effect, that society moves so fast that what we perceive as the present is actually the past, and what we see as the future is really the present. And the point about shale gas is it was built around a reality of an oil price that no longer exists. So there's all sorts of realities out there, but only if the economics actually support it. So I think your point about peak oil may be spot on, in terms of we don't realize this until after it happens. And I think an analogy, to go back to Charles's point about the material reality of our world, is, you know, the pandemic up to this point, and I suspect we're about to see a shift slightly, and I'll get to that in a moment, but the pandemic up to this point has sucked all the oxygen out of every single room. I mean, both by function of the virus, but also in terms of society's attention, that really all of society has been focused on this crisis and its adjacent crises. And so we've neglected a whole range of other issues. Because if you recall, just before this pandemic, climate was a pretty big issue. And I think that, you know, I think the pivot we're about to see is going to be the U.S. election. And I think a lot of attention is going to focus on the U.S. election as part of the pandemic. Because I think the pandemic, obviously, and the economy generally, are going to be big part of the election. But I think the real issue, which tragically is not going to be part of the election, but I think the moment that the pandemic starts to be tamed and starts to, you know, no longer dominate our lives, it's going to be climate. The extent to which, for example, the heat wave that's been in North America and Western Europe this summer, which has been ludicrous and breaking records and longer every year, the impact of climate volatility on the economy, the impact of climate in general on people's lives and people's health, is monstrous. But it's one of those things like peak oil that it's a whole lot easier to see after it happened, after the fact, they go, oh yeah, well, that's the impact. Because as the two of you guys know, I have the last 18 months been immersed in agriculture. And agriculture is something that I'm constantly absorbing, constantly learning. And to Charles's point, there are real crises in the food supply of the planet. you know, both in the economic sense of the pricing models and the commodity, but also in distribution and transportation, in terms of what we take for granted in terms of trade and tariffs, but also concentration of ownership and the way in which the agricultural industry is ludicrously consolidated. We see this now with the meat supply. I mean, most people don't realize that our meat supply right now is so precarious, it's crazy. It was triggered by the pandemic and outbreaks at meatpacking plants, which in North America are highly concentrated. But the ripple effect from that is still being felt, right? What's happened is small abattoirs and small butchers throughout the continent have taken on the load from all these farmers, and they're now booked up until 2021, which means farmers have all these animals that they're going to have to cull and bury, which means they're not going to reinvest, which means their operations are going to, like, the whole industry, that's just meat. Like, you go through any aspect of agriculture right now, and it has been so disrupted and is in such a crisis mode. And climate is part of it. Because growing conditions where we had a ludicrously wet spring, a crazy dry summer, all sorts of pests. I mean, you spend enough time in agricultural social media, as I do, which, by the way, is huge on TikTok, and you learn real quickly as to the current precarity of the agricultural sector and how that extends into our food supply as a whole. And so, you know, we talk in our podcast a lot about impending crisis and impending disaster. Well, anyone who wants to find one could just look at agriculture right now. And to Charles's point about material reality, that's huge. And that's where China is vulnerable, right? That's where, you know, there are a lot of countries. I mean, America is vulnerable as an exporter, but they're also vulnerable in terms of economic disparity and a lot of people starving. So there's all sorts of ways in which this isn't just digital. This is about economic reality. We could talk about the abstract in terms of a skewed economy and a Fed printing money. But when you get into how our food is made, that's when it gets real.
Yeah. Mark, do you mind if I jump in?
Go for it.
I just want to mention real quickly a topic that we've spent a lot of time on. It's near and dear to our hearts, centralization versus decentralization. And Jesse, what I hear you saying loud and clear is centralization in the concentration of power, of ownership, of distribution, that makes the system fragile, right? And we have a term for that, you know, and it's a tightly bound system, right? There's only a few key nodes and everything goes through those nodes. One node fails, the whole network fails, as opposed to the decentralized thing with hundreds of different nodes and you can, you know, find another route. Well, interestingly, China is right now, I think, at a critical juncture as a society and as an economy. A lot of it is super highly concentrated, right? Political power and money and that kind of stuff. But in terms of food, there's still like roughly between 400 and 600 million people in the West in villages. And so if something bad happens in the urban, you know, regions of China, a great number of people have a ancestral village to go home to. And that's something that I think I've often mentioned is so key, because here in the West, it's been, you know, generations since anybody lived on a farm, or there's the family farm got sold to a conglomerate when the property taxes went up and, you know, it was no longer economically viable, right? And so there, you may not enjoy life in the village because it's that dirt road or something to get to it, but you've probably got Wi-Fi. And you've got enough to eat. It may not be your preferred diet, but there's people are still growing stuff. And sadly, just like in Japan, most of the people growing food in China are elderly. You know, like the average age in North America, I think, is over 65, right, of farmers.
I mean,
and in Japan, it's over 70. So,
I think you're right that as a country, it would survive. But I think the amount of people who live in those Chinese cities.
Yeah.
The capacity in those rural communities doesn't exist. So while you're right, many people would be able to return to the land and a new generation could take over from their grandparents or great-grandparents. You'd still have a lot of really hungry people left in the city, and that's what rebellions are fueled on.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to push back on something you said, Jesse, and I have to phrase it very carefully because I don't want to be misunderstood. that when you were talking about climate, what I'm about to say has nothing to do with the reality of climate or not, whether, you know, what causes it. It's the narrative around climate. And what I think, I'm kind of going out on a limb here, what I think might happen, one of the consequences of the pandemic could be that the climate narrative is over for the foreseeable future because the public just has had enough, right? So they're just, in the sense that because everyone, the climate, so because I was thinking of that, because we were talking about the peak oil narrative, which was a pretty strong narrative for a while. And then, you know, circumstances went on without peak oil, and we had an oil glut, and nobody cares about peak oil.
Peak oil was always a tiny, tiny group of people who understood that.
Climate, I suppose. Okay, but hear me
larger.
Out.
Larger. Well, please continue.
So it's a huge narrative, and it was almost reaching a crescendo before coronavirus hit with Greta and all of this, you know, Extinction Rebellion. It just seemed almost crescendo-ish. And then COVID breaks out, and of course, everything in the world gets swept aside by COVID. But because of the kinds of radical life changes that were imposed on everybody because of coronavirus, I think people make, and I'm not saying it's a legitimate or a false equivalency in their mind, but there is this tendency to say, this is what we would be looking at under a radical decarbonization narrative, right? And people will just come out of this saying, look, when coronavirus finally eases off, people are going to say, what? We're going to go straight from coronavirus back to Extinction Rebellion? Are you kidding me? I just almost don't think. I think there's a kind of narrative exhaustion that is in danger of happening or about to happen. And so it's got to be replaced by something else. And I think what it could be replaced by is just whatever kind of chaos unfolds from the U.S. election in November.
So allow me to respond with all due respect and frame it in a way that I think you could understand so that you don't misinterpret your own ideological leanings for what I'm trying to describe in a non-ideological way. Okay,
but you do but know I'm talking about narratives and not realities.
100%, of 100%.
Okay. All right.
And therefore, that's why I am going to use slightly ideological language, but not necessarily my own when I describe this. So one way you could look at our current state right now is as a dictatorship of science. Right.
Yes.
In that,
yeah, sure.
The elected politicians have abdicated to public health authorities, using a crisis to justify the authority of power. Again, it's not what I believe, but I'm just offering a narrative. One could easily argue that climate science will be the next crisis to justify the continuation of this dictatorship of science.
It's entirely possible.
Authoritarianism.
Yes.
Continue. So to your point, the people who are against masks and think that the lockdown was unnecessary and that the coronavirus is a hoax, for sure they'll be at the front lines of fighting the climate change movement and wanting to see Greta Thunberg locked up. And like, I agree with that narrative with you 100%. But now that I've said all that, the majority, and I'm not saying this for myself, and I'm not saying that this is true, to go to your point of disclaimers.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of public opinion research currently being conducted, whether by organizations like the Pew Institute or Ipsos here in Canada, show the vast majority of the public support the public health measures that have been taken, swallowed the narrative of the pandemic front and center. And these are the same people who are going to do the same thing with climate change and who I thankfully say are doing the same thing with Black Lives Matter, in the sense that there have been the narratives that pre-pandemic, racism is bad, climate is something we should be concerned about, are actually being galvanized and consolidated in this time of crisis because there is a certain narrative hegemony that is coming through, and I'm saying this neutrally, I'm not my own judgment, through the consensus-based media we currently have. Because our current media does not really tolerate dissenting opinions. And so if you want to go promote an alternative therapy to COVID-19, you will not be tolerated, you will be suppressed, you will be blocked. All of that enables a reinvigorated, a re-empowered climate change movement to come in the wake of the pandemic and demand the type of system-wide economic changes that the climate movement has been calling for all along. And they will be backed up by the holy power on high of wild nature, because nature is going to get wild and we are going to see some crazy stuff, and it'll provide a very powerful backdrop for the climate narrative to be dumped. So I'm not saying this because I agree or disagree. I am, to your invitation, just presenting that I am coming out of.
You don't sense any kind of overshoot of the mean in the narrative, in the extremity of it? You would have like this sort of compensation to the other extreme after this?
No. So yes to the first part, no to the second, and I will tie it back to what I said to Charles earlier. Yes, I think they're jumping the shark. So in this Happy Days show that we're watching, Fonzie jumping the shark marks the turning point of the show. But I didn't see my first Happy Days episode until years after that aired, right? Because I didn't catch it on its first run, just because of my age. And so I think that there's something to be said about the climate narrative jumping the shark and it not mattering. The same way that the Chinese authorities can be outed as hypocrites and it doesn't matter.
Well, that's kind of...
at a certain point, dictatorships, if they're able to deliver on what they fundamentally promised, in the Chinese case, it's the mandate of heaven and prosperity, security for all. And in the climate change case, it's making everyone believe we're doing something about the environment, which quite frankly, we'll never know that we are or we're not. So it's pretty easy for them to actually deliver and for everyone to come united on. You know, notwithstanding Charles's point about, you know, the myths of the environmental movement are myths, because there's still a lot of plastic in the car and rare earth minerals and all sorts of other things that require nasty extractive industries, right? So the green revolution, when you get down to it, is not necessarily that green. But if we focus on the dictatorship of science, climate change is real, backed up by science. And while things are real, the policies proposed to deal with all that, probably not. But that may not detract from, to your point, the believability or consistency of the narrative of the climate change movement. So in closing, I don't think it's going to swing back to some other extreme. But where I do think it's vulnerable, vis-a-vis jumping over the shark, is like the pandemic. That a new narrative could come and just sweep it right off the table, right? And that is where I think it's narrative. Sorry, Charles. Go ahead.
No. I'm going to, you guys are on the Grand Prix in Monaco track here. It's really complicated and a lot of gear shifting. I'm going to just do a right turn here into a detour off that course. And hopefully it'll be entertaining, if nothing else, if I can make sure it's comprehensible. Okay, so in the 1960s, there was a whole movement connected to RAND Corporation, which is, you know, connected to the Pentagon, about nuclear war. And one of the famous books was Herman Kahn, Thinking the Unthinkable. And what made me think about this relating to climate change is there was a paper out of a working group in the Pentagon that was made public. It wasn't revealed by a insider or something like that. It was just, you know, made public as part of the standard, you know, Pentagon stuff. And it was basically looking at climate change as, well, what's going to happen? And how can we take advantage of what's going to happen? And so the thinking is kind of like you'd have to have seen the movie you know, Doctor Strangelove to really understand.
Is that it's one there, of my favorite movies of all time.
Exactly. You gotta love it. And so here's the thing. Herman Kahn was saying, okay, let's think about something awful and horrible like, you know, nuclear war. Well, we can substitute climate change for that because it's similarly catastrophic at the extremes, right? And so he says, well, let's just say we're going to have to win this thing. You know, so, okay, so we sacrifice, let's just, you know, okay, we're going to lose 50 million people. Well, okay, you know, now let's move on. And so with climate change, this Pentagon study that came out of an obscure working group, by the way, it wasn't a DIA, you know, Defense Intelligence Agency, or one of the big ones. It was like this little, you know, kind of side group that somebody set up. But it came out and said, okay, who's going to win and who's going to lose in climate change? And so you look at the flooding that's going on in China right now, and there's video clips of tremendous interest showing these entire rivers just sweeping away cars and freeways and stuff. And so it's like, well, gee, maybe climate change, we're going to win this. So I'm not interested in changing it, other than the narrative can make it, as to your point, Jesse, as long as we're looking like we're doing something, we're actually going to win this. Like, in other words, okay, South Florida's gone. Yeah, we can take it. We'll absorb that loss.
That actually is the official position of the Russian government, right? That they've actually openly stated and calculated that they are a beneficiary of climate change, that their northern climate, their northern seas will become accessible, right? That a lot of their geography will become better, that as an oil producing nation, they want to continue greenhouse gas emissions and increase consumption. So that's their open policy. So this isn't just speculation. There are absolutely game theorists who are thinking that way. And I agree, people within the US government, almost certainly, people think in the Canadian government, given our massive Arctic territories, that we're now building a navy to defend because we're starting to value them in a different way than we would have previously. So, I mean, that's perhaps Mark's, that may be the tragic response, Mark, to your suggestion that if the climate narrative tires, but climate change doesn't go away, then maybe there'll arise a cynical narrative on the right that says, or even on the left, that says, yeah, okay, climate change is what it is. Let's not fight it. Let's work it. Let's make it work for us. Let's figure a way to get around it. And, you know, maybe that means here in Canada, we start moving north and we start spending more time further north in the country. And, you know, instead of sending our elders off to Florida every winter, which will be underwater, you know, we send them to Vermont, because maybe Vermont in the winter all of a sudden will become a really nice place to be.
Well, you know, it was, who was it? It was a podcast with, I'm going to guess it was Mark Spiegel, and I could be wrong, who said, if, you know, isn't it more pragmatic? If climate change is going to cause $50 trillion of damage, let's say, if you can try to quantify it over the next 50 years. And if he said, you know, he did some back of the napkin math. He said, okay, if we electrify every car in the world at an expense of $20 trillion, we would reduce the carbon footprint by like such a ridiculously small amount, it would not change anything. It wouldn't change anything, but it would do a lot of feel good, look busy kind of, you know, yay climate, you know, yay doing something about climate change. But so what if we took the same money and just moved entire populations off of coastal floodplains, right? I just lost you guys.
Don't worry, keep going.
Oh, okay, so you're still on. Okay. And so if you spent the same money doing things that actually, you know, preserved life and just dealt with the reality of what was going to happen, isn't that a better way to go? And that's actually, that's the same thing. It's a kind of like almost, I don't know how to describe it, a hard-nosed pragmatism to say the climate, you know, if the climate is going to do what the climate is going to do, climate change has been with us since longer than the Industrial Revolution. I mean, there's a great book
we've lived in climates forever.
Yes, and like climate change has brought down empires before, you know,
and we'll do so again.
And we'll do so again. So I can understand that kind of game theory to say, you know, well, you know, we'll be on the right side of this one. I'm not endorsing it, but.
But what you're describing is where economic justice meets climate change, right? That the problem with a lot of the theoretical or abstract talk about climate change is when people talk about ignoring climate change, when people say we don't have to take it seriously, the subtext is they're supporting the war and the poor, right? They're supporting this idea that those who do not have the means of fending for themselves should be left to the whims of nature. And that is literally not a society, right? Like, you have a society because you say to people, we're going to offer a base level of security and support. You configure it based on freedoms. You configure it based on what people have to do as part of the social contract to be part of society. But, you know, for the most part, to your point about the areas most prone to flooding as a result of climate change, they're very poor areas. That these studies, like the research, really looks the people who will most be impacted by climate change are the world's poor. And so to do nothing is to say, you know, let the poor squalor, or as Charles liked to say, let them eat brioche, right? When instead, what we could do, to your point, is say, and this is what some of the Green New Deal people say, there's an economic opportunity here, that the infrastructure changes, the relocation, the, you know, types of responses necessary could actually stimulate an economy, could actually create a lot of jobs, could actually create a lot of economic activity if we had the wherewithal not just to anticipate what climate change is going to do, but mitigate its impact on communities, mitigate its impact on humans. And that's where economic justice has a role, because it is by default going to be the poor who get screwed compared to the rich who've already figured out why their mountain retreat or why their condo or why their private jet are going to allow them to live in a world of climate volatility.
I've got to speak up here just because that's so perfect a lead into a point I want to make, which is there was a paper issued recently on nature.com, right? Nature, the science journal, right? One of the key nodes in the dictatorship of science. And they were basically making an argument that it's the affluent who are the cause of all these difficulties, because the top 5%, you know, consume 40% of the resources. And yet the affluent have this feedback. They control the media. So the media says growth and affluence is wonderful. Then they create the social hierarchy that, hey, I want a mountain retreat. I want a Tesla. I want a vacation every month, etc. So then they create this huge pyramid of aspirational consumption beneath them. And then they self-justify all of this consumption with the Green New Deal or green technology. In other words, like, well, yeah, I have my Teslas and my mountain retreat. Oh, but I have solar panels on my mountain retreat. And, you know, I have my carbon footprint, you know, because I'm flying around 100,000 miles.
Isn't this how money was started? That paying for sins or something? Sorry, I digress. Please continue.
No. But so the story, the narrative of the green, you know, the green energy thing is really, it's a story of the affluent defending their overconsumption. And so when you talk about social or economic justice, the first thing no one wants to deal with is you're going to have to take away the overconsumption of the top 5%, one way or the other, revolution, you know, regulation, whatever. You've got to stop them from using 40% of the planet's resources for like this relative handful of people. Otherwise, there's not going to be enough left for the 90% you're talking about doing something for.
Sounds like that's a point to end on.
Yeah, especially because I've lost visual on both of you, which is kind of disorienting right now. So I feel like
on the one hand, I was going to say you're recording, so you shouldn't worry about whether we're there or not. But then I realized, no, you're recording, so you probably care if we're there or not.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear you. The audio's coming through, but what's going to show up in the video of this for the last few minutes of it are just two black squares where your heads used to be, right?
Which, well, I think is poetic for a black box society. Charles and I were taken over by the algorithms.
That's right.
This could be robot Jesse talking.
Yes,
right now,
this
rather than
this
human
is
Jesse.
This podcast passed a Turing test.
And then I would insert a TikTok feed just random into my box.
Right.
All right, good ending. Well, we still have you, Mark. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, we see all each and Jitsi does this where it rightly so prioritizes the audio over the video.
Yeah.
So it will abandon the video feed if that means saving the audio. And yeah. I think, Mark, in your office there in the building, you know, there are times when your connection, I think, just really kind of just slows right down. So I think one of your compatriots are uploading some huge file that seems to somehow throttle your infrastructure, though.
I'm usually the only person here when we do these, but has it happened today? Because we switched one of our network switches recently, and
it happened when we cut out. Because when we cut out, your audio got like really, really, really compressed, but you didn't break up. Like it still made it, but it came as close to you hanging up as possible.
Okay. Yeah. So Mark, I think you should stop playing Call of Duty 3 while we're doing this.
Yeah.
No, he's a Fortnite guy. Come on.
Oh, sorry, Fortnite.
You know, I don't play any of those video games. I never have. I don't know why.
Me neither. It's just an age thing, I guess, you know.
Yeah. I mean, even when I was in college and, you know, we would be in the computer lab and everybody would be playing all these computer games and I just never got into them. Possibly
you're playing a game. It's called capitalism.
Yeah,
not doing too badly.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I'll end on Flight Simulator for the Mac, circa 1986, which, you know, it was like a stripped, you know, airline. The plane was just lines, and it hung up every 10 seconds, and then you could kind of fly a little further. So, anyways, it's come a long way, and maybe that would be the retro game of the future. Would be like to go stripped down back to the original flight simulator where there's almost no action.
So I haven't been playing it lately, but I do play Farm Simulator. And what's interesting about Farm Simulator and the Farm Simulator community is how many farmers play Farm Simulator. And I've spoken at farmer events where I'll ask them, I'll say, okay, put up your hands. Anyone here plays Farm Simulator? And it's remarkable how, A, it's a way to exercise your imagination around your business, try out equipment you want to use without paying for it. And it reflects how so much of our life is a game. When we can play that game on the screen, it can be a very powerful cognitive exercise. My vice is this game called Civilization, which I've played throughout its series. It's now Civ 6. And I love it because it allows me to try out some of my political science ideas, some of my military ideas, some of my economic ideas, because it's literally like a full simulation of civilization that now features climate change, religion, diplomacy. It's like crazy, crazy layers and very all-consuming. So.
So are you saying that you can like spin up an anarcho-capitalist utopia and just see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, you can't really spin it up in the sense that unless you, I mean, you could. Usually you start in like 4000 BC. Mm. So you wouldn't get to, you know, that point until later in the game. But yes, you could run it however you desired with whatever policies you desired within certain constraints and in a world where people want to kill you.
Right.
So not all ideas are, you know, going to fly, but it's a very fun sandbox for such purposes.
It's interesting.
I use the word vice very deliberately.
Yeah.
Because it is ludicrously addictive, immersive. Like just like don't even look at the game. Study the addiction. Like just spend a Google search looking at the memes or jokes about people's addiction to Civ. because that in and of itself will give you a glimpse into the game and what it is and how it works.
All right.
I mean, to end on, the two of you both have published and authored books. I have not. The answer is Civilization. Good night.
All right. Okay, guys, we'll see you next week then.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.